Welcome to the Yes Indeed podcast, created by Mark Shepherd and run by me, Thomas Manuel. I think, dear listeners, that we might have a problem. I think we might not be on the same page. That's a clever, subtle, dare I say it, and I do dare, ingenious reference to the fact that my guest today designed the popular Same Page tool. Spoiler, he wishes he didn't. Or he wishes he didn't have to, at least. Ooh, what could that mean? Before we get to the interview and answer that juicy question, a word from our sponsors. Okay, I don't know why I waited so long there. The episode is sponsored, like all episodes, by my patrons over at Patreon. Patrons like David M.K., Michael Rachelson, C. Fursebner Eslau, Cassie Mothman, Kobiak, and Matthew Ursula. If you'd like to join them, head over to patreon.com/indierpg and help keep this podcast and the Indie RPG newsletter going. And with that out of the way, we can get to that interview. And I'm sitting down with Christopher Chin. Christopher is the blogger behind the long-running and well-loved Deeper in the Game blog. Started in 2007. The blog has about 15 years and more of thoughtful and insightful writing and advice on RPG design, play, and general geek culture. It's on my very short, very exclusive list of RPG media institutions. If you go right now to the Deeper in the Game site, which is linked in the show notes below, I am sure you will find something in the sidebar that either inspires or educates you. So, hello, Christopher. Welcome to the show. I'm so glad that you're here.
I'm glad to be here. It's pretty rare people reach out to me and ask to like talk and hear stuff, because I kind of just feel like I'm just shooting out into the void. So even hearing well-loved, I'm like, really? That's news to me. I mean, I'm glad to hear it. I think it's so funny because I think about when I first really got into the online internet RPG space, and I went to a Gen Con and met a bunch of people I knew online. And they're like, we thought you were this terrible, grumpy old man. Like you always sound so angry and snarly. And I was like, oh, I didn't realize. I mean, but then again, like early mid-2000s, a lot of the online RPG space was very, very hostile and aggressive. And, you know, you kind of had to set boundaries with people a lot.
Yeah.
I mean, you do in general anyway, but like it was just a lot worse then.
I think that's actually exactly where I want to start. Like, you know, what was the RPG ecosystem or scene like when you first started the Deeper in the Game blog? Was there something in particular that kind of convinced you, hey, I should start a blog and start putting my thoughts out there?
Well, actually, before Deeper in the Game, there was just Deep in the Game. And that was on Blogspot. That was like 2005, 2006.
Okay.
I think. And it was mostly just that. People don't know this, but at the time, RPGNet was really bad. It's extremely moderated now, but back then it was a free-for-all. Completely terrible. And I was really lucky when I found The Forge. The Forge still had a lot of problems, mind you. You still had like the most sort of nitpicky, pedantic sort of arguing happening. So it's like you didn't have a space to develop your idea without someone already trying to like, you know, King of the Hill punch you down about it, right? Which is really bad because all the really good ideas in The Forge, you couldn't ever just present something without having someone immediately ask the worst sort of like nitpicky question, and you couldn't just present an idea. So anytime people go with The Forge and you're like, I don't understand anything. It's like, yes, because we are all arguing with the worst person in the world. Not one person, but like many of us were the worst person, but it was just like, in that way, ideas were hard to transmit. And so I was like, you know what? If I have a blog, I can actually write my full idea without constantly having to fight people about it and just get the idea all the way out before we get into it, right? And I moved over to Deeper in the Game because, again, with the worst people in the world decide they all want to flood me with comments. And I was like, I'm not even writing for you guys. I'm writing for the people who I play with, who is not even you guys, right? I play with mostly people of color, which at the time was also harder to find, you know? Not saying that, you know, everything is swished, but it's a lot easier to find folks who are into role-playing games. And when you say role-playing game, people don't immediately go, I have no idea what you're talking about, right? Which was kind of the thing, like the early mid-2000s, we were coming out of all the design issues of the 90s. all the advice was railroad your players, lie to your players, punish the character if you don't like what the player's doing. A lot of really toxic stuff. And the story I tell everyone that sort of culminates it is, if you ever find a copy of First Edition Exalted and you read the introduction, in the introduction where it's talking about, oh, what is a role-playing game? You know, it does the usual game of imagination. And then it has this phrase, which is, rules exist to prevent bitterness between friends. And I was like, why would you, what, in what world does that make sense? Like, to do for fun? Oh, but if we do this wrong, we will turn from friends to enemies for real. Like, not in the game, but as at the table. I'm like, that's, and you wrote this. And then editors looked at this and said, yes, that's exactly it. And I was like, this is the game you want to do outreach beyond role-playing into anime fans. And I was like, you know, it just kind of tells you where someone who's been so deep in that culture mentality, like, of course rules are just there to stop you from becoming enemies. Like, what? Ruining friendships. Oh, yeah, I mean, that's part of the hobby. No, that's not reasonable. Oh, yeah, so when you play chess, we put you in a cage so the alligators can't bite you. Wait, why are there alligators? You know, it's the same kind of logic.
Yeah, it would be crazy if somebody described the rules of chess as there so that fights don't break out.
Exactly. Like there's some situations where I could be like, is there a bunch of gambling? I understand why there's certain rules. Like, but literally bitterness between friends. But also, what has gaming done to your life where that's a way that you think about it?
So I'm guessing you actually have an answer to that question. I think you've written about this to some extent. You have a post called the roots of the big problems or something like that, you kind of attribute a lot of the recurring concerns that people bring up, and they are recurring, right? And you know, this is something that people kind of comment about a lot, that a lot of issues in the hobby seem to show up every few years and people kind of have to kind of hash them out again and again. And one of the things you point out is that some of the white wolf kind of incubated play culture led the friends stopping being friends with each other. So is that something that strikes you as true? Like, yeah.
I mean, it's true, but I think the funny thing is it's not just White Wolf. Like, D&D also had a number of adventures and sort of play advice, which was railroad your players, right? I feel like they both did in different ways. D&D was a lot more about punish the character to try and get the players to change. Yeah. And, you know, both of them had just a really bad sort of setup with that. And it's just unfortunate because if you're going to put 4 to 6 hours into a single game for one time and then do it for weeks on end, you know, that's like everyone could go play a sport and maybe have a bad game or two, right? You know, you had a bad game, maybe you played with some people you didn't like, maybe, you know, you twisted your ankle, something happened, it wasn't great, but most of the time you're having fun, right? Generally, you're having fun or having a good enough time. And it's like, to think of like 4 to 6 hours of like try to lie and manipulate your friends, not just in the game like poker we're lying to each other, but like as how the game works and what we're doing as an activity, right? The activity is, oh, you can do anything. We're making a story together. Actually, I'm going to force you to do one of these few things, and I'm going to keep frustrating you and lying and sort of twisting your words until we get to one of the story results I am prepared for. And then when you say, I'm trying to do this, I come up with more and more elaborate reasons. At the end of the day, everyone says, it's because you're a bad role player. I mean, I'm glad. Things have definitely improved a lot. And so a lot of the stuff I wrote about, people are like, I don't know what he's talking about. I'm like, good, good, you know, great. You know, it's like, I want that to be as alien as like when people read about medieval people burying children underneath buildings. You're like, what the hell? And it's like, yes, that's the correct reaction. We should be, this is alien to us, right? Like,
yeah, yeah.
Not like, yeah, well, I don't know why you don't punish those players more. No, that's not what we want to do.
I do want to kind of circle back to this question of, you know, who you write the blog for, like, you know, your imagined audience. But I think first, I have, you know, a general question about, you know, as somebody who has been playing RPGs since the 80s, how would you describe your current playstyle, and has it changed? If so, like, you know, what led to those changes? Was it specific games, communities of play?
Yeah, I think like there was like two major things that changed my playstyle. The first one was, this was back in high school. I was playing Feng Shui. Mm-hmm. Feng Shui has martial arts, it's got magic, and it has time travel. And one of the rules in Feng Shui is that I didn't want to deal with time paradox. So the places you can travel time-wise are like hundreds of years apart, right? And that you can't really affect, like, you can't go back 100 years and change something and have it affect now. They didn't want to deal with all that. But as a GM, I looked at it and I said, why do we even have time travel if we can't have time paradox? Like, what's the point? Just make it another dimension. Like, here's a dimension where magic works. It's fine. Like, yeah. It just seems so pointless and ridiculous, right? And so I basically threw out the rule and had them actually doing time travel. And, you know, I just started improvising more. And I realized at a point I could just improvise what my NPCs are trying to do the same way my players are improvising what they're trying to do and set scenes that way. And I didn't have to prep every week, you know, other than, oh, what's this faction generally trying to do, right? And then I could just set scenes. And that led me to basically being able to break free of the railroad situation, right? Because now I had like, oh, here's tools I can do. And when the players started encountering their own paradoxes, they had a great time. They're like, wait, you mean that's probably us outside on the other side of the wall right now doing that thing we did three weeks ago? And they're like, crap, we can't go out there, right? And so it started creating fun stuff. And so that's where I first started getting into improvising in a way that is meaningful, as opposed to just, I don't have any notes, I'm pulling something out, right? But like, I could actually run this way and have it be consistent and not just me sort of doing something on an emergency. The second big bump, of course, was it wasn't just The Forge, but it was the games The Forge introduced me to. And one of the things that got really big was this game called The Pool. Hmm. It's a very simple free game. James West has it online. You can go download it. But the main thing The Pool added was this thing where if you roll a certain kind of success, you can now, as the player, narrate the outcome instead of the GM. And that basically spawned a bunch of games we call narration trading. And narration trading is like, well, sometimes someone else gets to do narration instead of the GM. And then when you add that in a game, you can't railroad, because the players could do something and completely change the situation. The GM has to roll with it. You can't just go, that's against my notes. You have to go, okay, that's what happened. Like, and the only restriction is sort of what the genre demands, right? Like, if we're doing a crime drama, you can't fly up into the sky like Superman suddenly. That, you know, that's the only requirement, is we have to fit with the genre that we're trying to, you know, the established rules we as the group have decided for the setting. But other than that, we can narrate. And once you can't railroad, everything becomes more free. Players get input. And it becomes very easy to focus on sort of the story aspects, because if someone wants something to be part of the story, they narrated it, right? You can't just, my plot's over here. No, the player's like, here's where all the fun stuff is. And they'll drag you there, and you just support them. So those are like the two major things that shaped all my real focus on role playing. And everything else other than that has just been tools to support that sort of play.
When I was speaking to Paul Beakley, who writes the Indie Game Reading Club, I was talking to him about how I see writing about games and art in general as a process of like learning about games and also learning about yourself. Is that one of the functions of the blog? Like, you kind of developing your improvised style, is the blog you working those thoughts out? Or...
Oh, I mean, absolutely. If you see anything that's a tool, it's a tool I wrote for myself, mm-hmm. right? Like, it was like, how can I make my prep easier to a level? And this has been the last 10 years. You know, a decade ago, I had a bout with cancer, which was pretty rough. And one of the side effects of both the cancer and the chemo is my memory has gotten a lot worse, right? And so sometimes, you know, I you know, if the ideas seem a little unfinished, it's because I'm like, if I don't get this idea out now, I will lose it. If I have it out now, I can go back and look at and develop it further later. But if I don't get it out now, I'm going to lose it, and then I won't have anything, right? And so sometimes there's an element of that, right? Which is frustrating to me, because one of the goals of my blog was to try and write things that were developed. I want most of my posts to be things that are evergreen and lasting. and not just topical. Like occasionally I'll be like, oh, there's a sale or this person's releasing a game or there's a fundraiser. But for the most part, I want it to be stuff that if you show up 15 years later, you will still find stuff 10, 20 years old and you'll be like, this is still useful, right? This actually applies to now. It's not just, you know, well, okay, great. That's fun for, you know, 2010, whatever, right? Like I want it to actually be stuff that's useful because I'd rather just write it once and be something we can always just refer back to, right? Rather than repeating myself over and over. That is actually part of why the blog occurred was because in those terrible threads, you repeat yourself over and over. And I was like, no, I'm just going to put it here. And then when you ask me this question, I will point you to this link and then you can read it. And I don't have to keep saying the same thing, you know?
That's really interesting, this idea of the blog being evergreen. Does that imply that there aren't posts that, you know, you might have changed your mind, that you would now kind of look back and go like, oh, actually, I disagree with that?
I mean, there's a couple of things, but for the most part, I think usually what it is, it's I disagree most of the time in nuance as opposed to the general thing. There's definitely a lot of stuff I'm like, boy, I could write that a lot better now. You know, I know I write really long posts and I know sometimes they're very rambly and like, I'm like, I could write that better. But at the same point, I'm like, is it worth the effort? I get maybe about 100 hits a day, which is a number, but it's not a huge number. You know, it's not like super huge blogs that get thousands of hits where it's like, well, if I just threw ads on here, I get some income. You know, it's like, it's a good hobby-sized blog, and it occasionally gets larger when someone new discovers the same page tool and then link it, and then, like, you know, a few hundred more people show up, and then the spike goes away, right? And then, you know, it's mostly just like, hey, I have a small group. Am I going to go back and rewrite some things? I don't know. I don't necessarily see situations when, you know, I follow links or occasionally look up, well, what are people saying? I usually don't see anything where someone's really thought about what I wrote to a point where I go, yeah, that's a good conversation. This is worth putting out. Most of the time I just see someone goes, hey, dudes, here's the same page tool. You know, your people are arguing about things you shouldn't argue about. I'm like, okay, well, that's what's there for. And then barely anything about anything else. Like I just recently wrote something and I said, this is primarily for designers. And the first conversation I saw, someone's like, well, I don't know what use it is for people playing. And I said, well, that's why it's mostly for design. I literally wrote that. Like, I told you, oh, okay, never mind. Like, you know, it's like, you know, what use is the manual about the car's engine to the average driver? Like, are you going to take it apart? No, you're just going to drive the engine. The person who fixes it, that's important for them. Like,
yeah.
Yeah.
And it's always there in case you want to get into that, right? Like every car comes with the manual so that you have the opportunity to kind of do it. And that's what I like. I like it when sort of theory and kind of play advice and, you know, general, you know, cultural musings kind of like cross-pollinate and merge with each other in the same space, because I do think people need all of them, right? Like you can, there is nothing less useful for a designer than knowing only RPG theory and not having any exposure to like how people are thinking about, like, you know, safety or generally play styles and things like that, you know?
Yeah, I mean, it's really interesting. Another thing that happened around the early mid 2000s was I ended up playing with tons of different groups. At the local game store, I basically said, hey, I will run one-shot D&D. At that point, it's third edition by the rules, just because I was trying to meet people. And so it's really interesting because you'd meet people, and, you know, even though you said it's by whatever's in the book, people didn't know basic stuff. Like, not even, you know, I know grappling rules are always a mess in D&D, but it was like third edition. One of the biggest rules was five foot square move. I forget if they called it a shift, or it was like a free step you could take. Right. You know, that didn't take an action versus like a full move. And people didn't know those. Like lots of people didn't know. And it just kind of really revealed to me. I was like, ah, everyone says they're playing the same game, but they're really not playing the same game. Right. Like, even if you play with your own home rules and stuff and you see someone's like, I'm playing by the book, you might go, oh, let me refresh myself so I know what they're doing. And they're like, no, of course everyone ignores that rule. I know that's not actually true. Like, but I got to play with a lot of people there, did a couple Gen Cons, got to play with a bunch of people there. I had some friends who were playing very traditional RPGs and I got to play with them some stuff. And so like you get exposed to a ton of groups. Had some folks, I used to run a, what was called an apartment convention. You basically like 10, 20 of your friends show up to your apartment over a weekend and you play. And I got to play with a lot of people over that. And so it's like you get exposed to a lot of different styles, a lot of different folks playing different games. And it was really funny because the thing I always got accused of, like, Chris's stuff is all theory. He never plays any games. And it's like no one plays that way. I'm like, no, the whole reason we have the same page tool is because I keep meeting people who play different ways and they actually don't understand anyone plays any other way. Like, maybe they know two ways people play. There's our way, and there's those people over there who play like that. No, there's like 50 other groups you don't even know. Like, yeah.
It is interesting that we now know, or at least it's now generally kind of accepted, you know, because of John Peterson's work and things like that, that from the moment D&D was published, people were playing it differently. Like, there's 100% like play styles that emerge like from the second of that game existing.
Which, at the time, I didn't really know a lot about wargaming, but as I learned more about wargaming, I was like, oh, well, that makes perfect sense, because literally, what's the first thing every wargamer group does is they're like, let's bend the rules this way. Let's make some supplement rules. You know, I want to add this into the game. And so like that, of course, that's what they do. But that's part of the hobby is the tinkery, mm-hmm. right? I think the thing we lost, though, is war games. Certainly you can tinker all you want, but if you hold a competition, then the rules have to come to some baseline. Everyone goes, okay, we actually have to come to some baseline and agree that those rules exist. And I know D&D had its competitions or whatever, but those were also kind of weird in their own way. But like generally our hobby, RPG hobby, never really got that. And so it's always set up as this weird ideological thing when you say like, I want you to play the rules as written. It's not because the rules as written are like the holy text, but it's like, let's use this as our starting point because something has to be solid that we all agree on. And then we can kind of negotiate and move from there. Like, especially when you're playing with strangers, it's like, what's your communication style? You know, I don't know your communication style. And maybe if we have these set rules, we have one thing that's solid and then we can learn about each other with everything else outside of that. Right. And then start to adjust. But since everything has always been rule zero and GM fiat and a couple decades of companies really pushing like, this is what makes you a good role player and a good person. It's very much like sort of this nationalistic or religious sort of thing. Like, if you play our way, you're a real role player. And if you play like that, you're not really role playing. You're not even playing a game. And it's like, I'm sorry, guy. This is not that serious, right? Like, you know, like there are things I think we can put into role playing games that are very serious. And I mean, I talk about them, like when people put hateful bigotry in the game, I'm like, wow, that's what you do for fun. Huh? This is the most important part of this game to you is to include this. That's telling and very concerning.
You know, maybe this is the good point to circle back to the question of who you're writing for. The tagline for your blog is From Geekdom to Freedom. I think the first line of the about page says kind of explicitly that you're writing for geeks of color and marginalized folks, quote, who have always been at creative forefronts, even as we face gatekeeping, erasure, and plagiarism. Could you like tell me about like, you know, why those lines are important to you and whether you still see the blog in that way?
Oh, absolutely. So the Feng Shui group that I ran for back in high school, they're all ex-Crips. Mm. They're all ex-gang members, right? Like we met because we were all into hip-hop, anime, and Hong Kong movies, right? It's funny because, you know, sort of like people always think like, it was just one of the most frustrating things because there is a lot of racism, anti-blackness in the role-playing community. It was much worse back then. But like, the people are like, oh, those kind of people aren't interested. I'm like, absolutely, they are. Have you listened to rap music? They're always talking about comic book characters, anime. Like, they're already geeks. Wu-Tang Clan is geeks. The whole thing is Wu-Tang. They're kung fu.
Yeah.
Naming themselves Tony Stark. Like, everything is geek stuff, right? And so, like, we all got together on some geek stuff, and it was funny because my best friend at the time, he comes over to my place and he sees my bookshelf. He's like, is that a role-playing game? I said, yeah. He's like, wait, you're into those? I'm like, yeah, you're into them. And the problem was, we were like, we couldn't find anyone to play with. And he goes over to another friend's play, you know, another person he meets. He's like, hey, is that a role play game? And so like, you have all these ex gang members who are all like, shit, I couldn't find anyone to role play with. So we all started role playing, right? And so it was fun because we're playing Feng Shui. I started off as, we had all seen John Woo movies. So I just told him, I said, your characters are all going to be triad and organized crime. And I didn't tell him about all this magic stuff. I just said, we're just going to play it like this. And we did a couple sessions where it's all just like criminal drama action. And then people start showing up and doing magic. And they're like, wait, what's going on? And then like, we explored the whole sort of Feng Shui time travel multiverse thing from that. And it was like really fun because we were all into the same stuff. So we had that common language. But those are the folks I really started with. Obviously, most of those folks are not deep into theory, but like the people who are into stuff, they are looking at the tools. And, you know, as my circles have expanded and it got easier to connect with other geeks of color, those are still basically the people I write for, even though I know probably the majority of people are like, you know, white redders or something who finds my blog and they're like, you know, a same page tool, or, you know, maybe they want to look at like the old Forge Theory stuff and get angry that the Forge Theory stuff existed, you know, like whatever.
You know, I'm sensing a little animosity about the popularity of the same page tool, Chris.
Well, it's because it's a crutch. Mm. It's supposed to do, it would be useless.
Oh, wow. Okay.
So if you are clear on what your game is supposed to do, people should be able to look at your game and then they should already be on that same page, right?
Interesting.
This actually all literally comes out of that thing where I said 80s and 90s game design, a lot of them, they tried to do everything at once. You know, if you show up with your friends and they say, let's play cards, you're like, okay, cool. What game are we playing? They start passing out cards. You're like, but which game are we playing? We're playing cards. You know, it's like, we can't do that, you know? What game are we playing? We're playing sports. Okay, which sport? Sports. And everyone shows up with the wrong equipment, right? Because no one knows what sport they're playing. And same page tool is basically that. It's like your game designer has failed you and you're finding this useful. Like, it shouldn't be mind blowing. Initially, coming out of the 80s and 90s design, I'm like, okay, I get why we need this. It's 2023 and we still have people hitting it, which tells me that people are still failing to design their games correctly, right? Mm-hmm. Like, and I'm not saying it has to be a specific checklist of the things on there. Like I said, that list is just the most immediate things I could think of. But if you successfully told people what this game is about and the expectations of the players, and if you have a GM, what the GM's role is, then you should look at that tool and you go, why would I use that? It's in the book already.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. I guess a lot of, you know, post-Forge sort of indie design has been, let's make games that actually tell people what to do and how to do them. Yeah.
Right.
So is there something on the blog that you're particularly proud of, something that stands out to you as maybe something that should have been as popular as the same page too, but does not get those same clicks?
I probably would say a lot of my stuff about flag systems is really good, but it is also sort of like, again, another sort of thing designed out of a failure of a system, right? Like a lot of the games that I really love already have flags built into them. It's a very good tool.
Do you want to explain to the audience what you mean by flags there?
Good point. So if we're playing a role-playing game and the primary focus of this game is to focus on the story of the protagonist, every player character can have one or more things that explicitly say, this is what I want my character's story to focus around. So, you know, if we have this classic sort of struggle for a throne fantasy thing, and you have loyal to the king as a flag, it's written on your sheet. The entire group knows the thing you want to do with this character is deal with struggles around the loyalty to the king. And so it's a flag because, like a flag, you wave it and everyone can see it. The thing that I really love is there's games like Primetime Adventures, Burning Wheel games have this, the old Riddle of Steel. They basically have it to where this is tied into your character right up front. Everyone knows and everyone can coordinate the story. And a lot of times when this first came out, people would see it and they go, oh yeah, well, this character has like a level 20 skill in sword fighting. They want their character to be about sword fighting. I said, well, you don't know that. They might actually have taken that really high sword fighting because that's the most boring part of the game to them. And they know they need it just to survive, so they can tell the other story they want to do, right? Or maybe it's like, well, they're a retired duelist and they actually want to deal with like regret. And they actually don't want to use violence, but they took that because that reflects their history. Like, you don't know unless it's explicit. And that's why it has to be an explicit thing, and it also has to be built into your game. And so you can tape it onto other game systems, which is why I wrote those articles. But it's also just sort of sad to me because I keep seeing people go like, oh, I want this game to be about this story, but we can't seem to get it focused. And I'm like, well, if you put a flag system or just explicitly say, we want our character's stories to be about this, then everyone knows what's going on. Like, yeah.
Yeah. Have you played Heart from Rowan Rook and Deckard?
I have not yet played Heart.
People got excited about it because it did exactly this to some extent. Like, the way you advance is you choose like beats that you want to hit, and it's now the GM's job to kind of facilitate you hitting those beats so that you can then level up. And it was, again, just a very simple kind of, okay, if you choose this class, you might want to do these things, and just kind of setting up that piece of communication. But, you know, if you go back one step from there, playbook design is also about that. A lot of times the kind of thought process that a game suggests in choosing a playbook is like, choose this playbook if you want this kind of story and things like that. Yeah. These are all examples of what you're talking about, right?
Yeah, yeah. And it's sort of frustrating because, like I said, this is stuff that goes back to Primetime Adventures, I think, came out originally around, I think the first edition was maybe 2007, 2006. It's a while back.
Yeah, yeah.
But the thing that I think is really interesting that is sort of the next step to that is, you have the flag, and usually within two or three sessions, you realize that flag is not actually what the player wants.
Oh, nice. Yeah.
Right. And so this is sort of like, this is when the role playing gets really good. Like, someone said, oh, I'm worried about, you know, it's loyalty to the throne. And then you realize, no. This is about your reputation and the legacy you leave. But like, the player doesn't consciously recognize that. And you have to pay attention. And then when you pick up on it, you, as a GM, you shift a little, and it gets much more meaningful to the player. And maybe the player picks up on it, and then they change their flag to meet it, right? And so this is where you start getting very good, very advanced kind of play, but we can't get there until we've already gotten flags, right?
If you sense my general frustration, it's mostly that I'm like, I would like to get caught up to things we were talking about 20 years ago, right? Like, that's basically like, there's a lot of cool stuff I would like to develop, but, and that's the reason there's so much theory on my blog, is that sometimes to get to the next step, we have to have like gotten a certain level of savvy or understanding to even meaningfully talk about it.
So what kind of games do you play now? Are those games that have this stuff built in, or have you just found ways of like, your GMing just incorporates stuff like flags regardless of what game?
Well, right now, I just started a new Apocalypse World game.
Nice.
With several people I've played with for many years, but only one of them has played Apocalypse World before. We've played a lot of PBTA, so part of the thing is I'm sort of highlighting, these are the things Apocalypse World does that maybe the PBTA's dropped along the way.
Yeah.
And so one thing I've kind of, I mean, Apocalypse World is naturally a narrativist thing. It just doesn't have big flags. What usually is, you look at where the players are willing to get, risk a lot and get really violent. You know, it's a violent game, like, but you know, where they're willing to put their characters at risk and do a lot of intense action, you go, that's the thing that matters to them. And the only sort of side thing I'm sort of doing with this is, I've realized over the years of playing Apocalypse World, is whenever someone does the game world has a psychic maelstrom you can open your brain to, that's basically like, get mystic visions and learn information, but it's usually disturbing. So I was like, I can use the psychic maelstrom as the way to really poke at whatever someone's issues are.
Yeah.
Right. So we have a character who's playing the medic. I'm like, every time they do that, the vision will always be the dead bodies of the people they couldn't save talking to them. Right. Like just find the thing and sort of like work from there. Right. The other game I'm playing doesn't have flags, but boy, you'll find out what your character is about very quickly. It's Errant. I guess some people call it new SR instead of OSR. it mostly is a game that has taken sort of the dungeon crawl idea from, say, like basic D&D. Like, there's set turns, there's an exploration phase, all that kind of stuff. But instead of it just being like random rule for encountering monsters, the random rule determines stuff like, do your torches burn down a bit more this turn? You know, do you find a clue? And so every turn, something interesting is happening. And part of it is it does the huge cycle of action, downtime. And downtime is when you go blow all the money your adventurers made wastefully and like then like get XP. And the thing about it is I sold it to my players as our flag meets death meets Darkest Dungeon, right? Like, because it's clear these characters are going to be completely ridiculous and just go all out. And that's where things have started. And, you know, they did a couple dungeons. They've done a couple downtimes. But the downtime parts are where you find out really fun stuff, because it's the ways the players get into trouble and get out of trouble. And our players have currently decided the thing to do is start a three-way faction war in the city. So downtime is paused while everything is burning down around them. And it's like, yes, you're getting XP, because when you lose things in Erend, you get XP, but you're also now destroying all the infrastructure that will help you in future adventures, right? So, so it's completely silly, but like at the same point, when you follow what the players want, you're getting very fun stories, right? Like, yeah.
Erend is a super interesting game designed by Ava Islam and Kill Jesu Games. And yeah, it's something I wanted to play because it has all this ornamentation, right? It has a very core sort of procedure and then has just so much other stuff which looks fun to kind of mess around with.
One of the things that really sold me on it, it's very easy to improvise stunts and advantage and disadvantage in the game, which I think is very key if you want to have a combat heavy sort of game. You know, if it's just I hit, you hit, that's not interesting to me. But if it's like, well, what do? I throw the pot of boiling stew at the monster. Oh, okay, well, that's going to stun it. Like, that's interesting, right? Like,
nice, yeah.
My goal whenever it's an action game is I want to turn to a Jackie Chan.
Nice.
I want people to, you know, do stunts. I want things to break. Yeah, I want chaos.
Yeah. Okay, yeah. With the kind of slow crumbling of social media as a space, there are a lot of people who are interested in getting into blogs and just blogging more. Is there advice that you would give to someone who's like, I want to start a blog now and I kind of want to make it a practice?
Yeah, I think there's basically two methods that people I've seen work really well. There's a lot of people who I've seen, again, in sort of that new SR space. They get an idea for a cool little mechanic, and then they just post it, right? Like, there's maybe a couple games they really love, and they're always talking about those games. Maybe they get an idea for a monster, and then they post it. And individually, you know, people may or not like that particular idea, but as you build up a corpus of ideas, people who are into that game or related games will, like, click on it. They'll be like, oh, yes, I like half their monsters, but it's enough for me to keep checking it out, right? So I think people who are very much into a couple of games and have lots of little ideas, that's one way to do it. The other way to do it that I think is useful, that I do sometimes, is if I have a very big idea, I'll make a whole series about it, right? And I think that can be useful because you start thinking, okay, there's three big topics I want to cover here. And so now instead of like, I wrote one post, what do I write next? You're like, I wrote about this and now I'm going to have to write about this next part. And, you know, it's not that you don't like the ideas, but sometimes if your idea is big, it's really hard to like verbalize, right? It's like, it's the same thing like why it's easy for me to prep my own GM notes. And it's terrible for me to think about if I had to write this for someone else to read, it'd be like five times as long,
yeah.
Right? Because I can't do my own shortcut notes or assume if it's this type of character, I'm automatically going to use them in this way. Like, you have to start explaining some logics to people who are in your head. And so that's one of the difficult parts to blogging, right? Is that you start going like, I have this idea and I need to make sure I give enough that people can follow me on it and not just like I've jumped 20 steps ahead and lost everyone.
Yeah.
And I think I fail at that a lot, but you know, I try.
Yeah, I really connect with that thing about like having big ideas and then kind of getting stuck in how do I sit down and write all of this. And one of the things I do is I will break down the big idea into like three sections. And then I look at those sections and be like, can I write this in one shot? And I'll be like, no. Then I'll break that down into three sections and I'll be like, okay. Till I can be like, I can do this.
I honestly wrote a lot about dungeon design and I look at it, I'm like, this is a complete mess, but the ideas are there. And I'm like, if I had better writing skill, I could like reformat this, but I don't know if I have the energy, right? That's the other half of it. Oh, I guess like another thing I could say is helpful if people want to get into blogging is if you're looking at other things that involve game design or gameplay, it will often inspire you. It'll either inspire you because like, that's a good idea, but I'd like to add this, or you go, that's a bad idea and I want to write this instead, and probably pick up my blog as like half of that. Like I have a whole thing called Forsaken Conversations and it's like, it was someone's bad idea at least inspired me to write the good idea, right? And I try not to like point to specific things because the point is not to down on this, whichever individual happened to say the thing, right? Or the, you know, it's like, unless you're doing bigotry where I'm like, yeah, please don't buy their games. But it's like, generally, like someone says something that's just a bad idea. Mostly the thing is I want to correct you to a better idea, right?
Yeah. Okay. I think it is time for us to get into my standard questions.
Okay.
So the first one that I ask everybody who comes on the show is in a section called Infectious Enthusiasm. I ask, what's a game that you've had a lot of fun with and you want to recommend?
I'm definitely going to say Errant. Errant has been a lot more fun than we expected. I'm not saying we didn't expect it to be fun, but the players I was playing with mostly did a lot of 5e D&D. And it was sort of like one of those things where like I talk a little bit about the idea, they got excited, they started reading the rules, they got progressively more excited. They would come up with a character idea. It, like every step just made everyone more and more excited and more into the game. It helps that the rules are available for free.
Yeah.
So you can just, you know, get the free version of the rules, comes with no art, but you can play the whole game. And then just like since then, it's been like I said, right now we're having a three-way faction war and it's completely, you know, like I'm like, okay, I didn't plan for a three-way faction war, but we've got it. Let's go.
So is the thing that got them excited about Errant your pitch of our flag means death plus Darkest Dungeon? Is that what got them excited? Was there something else that you said that first hooked them?
That helped a little bit. Like part of what I do whenever I try and get ready for a game is I make a one-page sheet. That's my pitch page.
Nice.
Right? My pitch page will have some ideas, some description. I'll steal some photos from the internet that kind of get the vibe. And, you know, that's sort of my, like, let's get on the same genre page. Let's get on the same idea of how this works.
Yeah.
And then, you know, then of course there's questions and answers, but like one of my players who is, they're pretty solid into rules. They took a look and they loved it. And so like that, as each person gets into it in their own way, it pitches off and gets another person excited. Yeah. I think that's one of the key things is that pitch page helps. It also lets you sort of break down some basic rules, the quick sheets I occasionally talk about on my blog, because it helps you understand as a GM or the person pitching the game and also helps the players and everyone else learn it too.
Nice. The next section is called Tyranny of Numbers. I ask, is there a number or statistic that you can share that you think would be useful to my audience?
I do a blog. I have a Patreon. You know, blogging is not a way to make money. I'll tell everyone I make about $80 a month.
Yeah.
Covers some groceries, you know? Like, at the time when I started, I actually started the Patreon because that was my time when I was fighting cancer. And so I really needed every dollar I could get. And there was only so much work you could do when you're in a hospital bed.
Yeah.
Like most of the time. So like blog because you like to blog. If you have products or something that you're making, like if you're making your own games, if you're making like some kind of merch, the blog can serve as a way to sell that kind of stuff if you're into it. But, you know, blogging is fun. Do it because it's fun. You know, maybe if I made a book in the future, I would charge people. But boy, that sounds like more work and I don't have the energy for more work, you know? I mean, I guess that's a secondary useful thing to think about is anything you're doing as a project, scale it to your energy level, right? We're in role-playing games. We love to imagine big ideas. It's always easy to imagine a big project and then get into it. You burn yourself out and then you don't have a project to the end. So like it's a double loss, right? As opposed to just, you know, that project is too big for me. So I'm going to scale it back to something I can do or I'm just going to enjoy my time. Like, just, you know, I think it's really important to kind of think about the scale of projects before you get into them, even if it's like blogging, right? For our streaming, when we do streaming on Sundays, like our basic rule is we go, when this becomes more work than fun, we're going to stop. Right? Like, we are under no illusion that's like, oh, we're going to become big name streamers. Like, no, we're doing this to show people how games work with normal people playing the game, not like people who are professional actors, not people who have a full set. Just how do you play a game? Like, how's it work? How's it flow? You know? So having the scale right and having your, like, this is where I opt out. Like, this is too much. I'm opting out. Like, if you're doing a blog, maybe you look at it and go, you know, if I can't post once a month, maybe it's time for me to stop. Like, once a month is probably doable, you know? So, you know, you don't have to do every week. I know some people try and do it like every 2 or 3 days because they want to chase engagement numbers. But like, the problem is that if you're doing that, you're not going to have material that's going to last. You're just kind of jamming stuff out, and eventually it's like, it's burning you out. And then people will look at your blog and they'll go like, yeah, there's 5 good posts out of like 8 years of stuff, you know? As opposed to, you know, I try and do it once a month if I can, and sort of try and think what's something that will last a little longer than that, you know.
The next section is titled Replay. I ask, is there a gaming story you'd like to share?
So Tenra Bansho Zero, mm-hmm. It's a Japanese tabletop RPG. I like to call it Japan's Rifts, because it's basically Rifts. You've got like magic, you've got ghosts, you've got mecha, you know, cyborgs, you got all there.
It.
It has a mechanic that's really awesome that I wish more games would kind of pick up. It's called the emotion matrix.
Okay.
So when you play Tenra, when any major protagonist meets another major character, you roll on the emotion matrix. And basically it's sort of like, what is the first read these two characters get from each other?
Oh, wow.
Right? It works a little like improv. Like, you know, when people feed an improv person, like, okay, you two just met on the street and this person did this. And like, you know, it kind of gives you a prompt, right? Yeah. Except these are all very anime, right? Like, you look at each other and you know you're going to be right. It's like, you know, stuff like that, right? And the only drawback I have to the emotion matrix is a lot of the language is kind of vague, which makes it a little harder to use. But we're playing Tenra, and basically a character meets basically this young mecha pilot. You know, part of the rule in Tenra is that all the pilots are like child soldiers because anime, right? And so we roll on the emotion matrix and we get this horrible result, which is love, right? And I'm like, no, you're not going to be in love with a child. That's disgusting, right? And we're all in agreement, right? You can spend points to bump it around the chart. It's a grid chart, so you spend a point, you can move one of the 4 cardinal direction, and we bounced it over to, I think, it was like older sibling, like protective, right? Which I was like, that makes sense, and we all got really hyped about, because like, no, that's exactly perfect, right? And I think that was a really cool thing, where you have this thing that serves as an inspiration point, but because people can input on it, you will drive it towards the things the group wants, right? Like, the group will go, this is actually cooler, right? We want this instead. And so you have a little bit of randomness and a little bit of player input put together, and it starts to create stories you don't exactly predict, but also aren't so far out of fetch that you're just like, this has ruined my game experience, right?
In the final section titled All Advice is Advice for Myself, I ask, what's a habit or technique you're trying to get better at doing at your table?
Probably the number one thing I'm trying to do is not keep dropping loose ends. So usually the thing is I create sort of a general structure for whatever the setting, the factions, the NPCs. And my players know that wherever they're going to try and take their characters or explore into, I will generate material, right? Yeah, and not to say like if you just want to waste 2 hours talking to the shopkeep, I'm not going to go with that. I'll be like, where are you trying to get at here, right? But like, if there's something interesting you're trying to explore, I'm willing to expand it outward, right? And I'm good enough at that the players can't tell what's prepped and what's in my head versus what I'm improvising. But the drawback is, because that's so much material I wasn't necessarily planning on focusing on, we end up starting to drop threads elsewhere of characters, of setting and stuff. And so I'm trying to get better at being able to loop those back in. And the trick I actually started doing with this Apocalypse World game is I've set up a Kanban board with cards for every NPC or faction. And what I'm doing is between sessions, I'm tagging, I have a little tag that says next session to remind myself, bring this character, bring this thing back in because this is going to matter soon, right? Like, nice. Like, oh, they did this. This angered this faction. They're going to show up next session to do something about that, right? Like, or, you know, this person is impressed with you and they want to get you on their side. You know, like, just little notes to myself. And I think that'll work a little better. We'll see. It's an experiment, right?
There is something really satisfying about being able to find a way to connect threads that weren't connected, right? Like, that's one of the great joys of GMing as well.
Yeah.
Okay, Chris, I think that was the interview. That was really nice. I had a great time. Hope you enjoyed it. But before we go, do you have some links that you'd like me to share?
I mean, just go ahead and share my blog. You know, that's the place that I write. I think you mentioned a little earlier that we had the long death of social media and spaces are disappearing. And that's an unfortunate reality. You know, some of it is about the format of places and some of it's sort of the social space. So I think the reason people have blogs is blogs are like the, you know, how bacteria can form a shell and survive the bad times. Blogs are sort of the way we can do that, you know, preserve some ideas, even if the social media is dead. And when something new flourishes, everyone can link stuff again and, you know, start growing again.
Well, thanks for listening. That's the end of this episode. I'm kind of liking the music that I used for this episode. It's the Element song from comedian and mathematician Tom Lehrer. I think before he died, he put all of his musical output in the public domain. So I get to use it in podcasts like this, and I think that's pretty cool. And it puts a smile on my face, so maybe it sticks. Till next time. As Marx used to say, does indie need you? Yes, indeed.
And cadmium and calcium and chromium and curium. There's sulfur, californium, and fermium, berkelium, and also mendelevium, einsteinium, nobelium, and argon, kryptonian, radon, xenon, zinc, and rhodium, and chlorine, carbon, cobalt, copper, tungsten, tin, and sodium. These are the only ones of which the news has come to Harvard. And there may be many others, but they haven't been discovered.